Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
Hello, my name is Eloise Grills, and I'm a writer, artist, and teacher interested in ideas and politics surrounding the body. I'd like to respectfully acknowledge that today I am speaking from the lands of the Kulin Nation, in particular the Dja Dja people. I pay respects to their elders and to the elders of all communities and cultures across this continent for their continuing custodianship of this land. So first off, I'd like to introduce my guest today for a new body politic. Sarah Walker is a writer, artist, and photographer who makes work about anxiety, control, and intimacy. She is a Walkley nominated critic, was runner-up in the 2019 Calibre Essay Prize, and received the 2020 ABR Victorian Rising Star Award. Her newly released book, The First Time I Thought I Was Dying, won the 2021 Quentin Bryce Award. And we're also joined by Sam Van Sweden. Sam Van Sweden is a Melbourne-based writer interested in memory, food, mental health, and the body. Her debut book, Eating With My Mouth Open, won the 2019 Kill Your Darlings Unpublished Manuscript Award and is available now. To begin with, I have asked these two writers to read a short excerpt from their book. So first off, we have Sam Van Sweden reading from Eating With My Mouth Open.
Thanks, Eloise. Likewise, I would like to pay respects to traditional owners of the land that I'm on Wurundjeri country in West Footscray. I'm reading from Eating With My Mouth Open, a passage sort of close to the start. Dieting can feel like a superpower. It creates an illusion of control. Dieting makes a body seem, if just for a moment, like a thing that can be manipulated perfectly. This unruly flesh bag becomes an accessory. By restricting and recording, by exerting and counting, the body can be subdued. Willpower is peddled as an inexhaustible resource and one that reflects personal wealth. Worth. All that's required is perfection, accompanied by shame and absolute repentance for the body's continual weakness and failures. The counting and the weighing, saying and saying loudly, no, I don't do that anymore. It's so within my control, even as it's slipping through my fingers, I've got this. The numbers are solid and irrefutable, so soothing, so real. The time spent concentrating deeply on morphing into a better version of yourself is rewarding and meaningful. Gender and sexuality philosopher Cressida J. Hayes observes that it is a feminist commonplace that many women's achievements go unrecognized or are invisible. Losing weight, however, provokes ready congratulation. It is tangible and can be graphed and tracked. It has setbacks and successes that seem clear-cut. When dieting, I become less, and the shrinking can be displayed in a downward curve on a graph. I'm smaller, I'm weaker, I'm lighter, I'm more timid. I am preoccupied always with the boundaries of my body, what goes in, what goes out. And still I lose. No matter how hard I try, I cannot build myself a destination. I shrink and continue to shrink, and I can't seem to disappear right. I never arrive. My body, monstrous, returns again. The more I try to shove it inside new packaging, the more monstrous it becomes. Uncontrollable. Out of control. These things are the same, but different too. I wonder whether this focus on food, here, in this project, in life in general, is a way for me to justify my consumption, which at times has been quite incredible. Is it a way of looking back at versions of myself that have been less in control than I'd thought at the time and excusing that behaviour? A way of ridding myself of all of this shame? No matter how I try to dump my body, it keeps coming back because I live here.
Thank you so much, Sam. That was a really powerful reading and spoke to a lot of the ideas that I wanted to ask you about today. So that's fantastic. Sarah, would you like to read us an excerpt from your book?
Sure. I'd like to note that I'm reading on Warrawarrung country in Geelong, Australia, and I'd like to pay my respects to the people who've been here a lot longer than I have been. I'm going to read a couple of little bits from the first essay in my book, The First Time I Thought I Was Dying, which is called Healing Brush. The first thing you need to know is that the camera always lies. Light the subject from above and cheekbones emerge from the face. Add a softbox and the years slide away. The camera is a machine and data gains meaning in the interpretation. Photographs reveal only that reality is changeable, labile. Shift a reflector and the world moves with it. The ultimate lesson is that the most powerful force is light. I remember the exact moment I realized I was fat. It was Christmas, I was 12. I was standing in my grandmother's spare room, the lace curtains filtering the sunlight into soft licks. I remember the pants distinctly, a pair of pale blue and white short trousers fitted at the thighs. They were patterned with flowers, a pastel Eden. As I passed the mirror, I saw a stranger. The body I'd looked at my whole life had shifted in a single moment of monstrous clarity. The thighs strained the seams of the floral pants. The stomach was distended and bloated. Only the face I recognised as mine. I had the sensation of expanding uncontrollably, fat bubbling under my skin, flooding my clothes. As a child, I had checked the mirror to admire my surfaces, outfits, and expressions. I'd never given much thought to what lay underneath. In this room smelling of powder, I looked at myself for the first time with an adult gaze. I looked at my body and used a word I had never used for it before, and in doing so, I was altered irrevocably. Words are weapons. As I called myself fat, I went to war. In my 20s, I revealed to a female friend my starved little secret. I was expecting hushed words, shock, pity. Instead, she nodded. So, basically, you were a teenage girl. I took my greyhound recently to see the vet. She coaxed him onto the scale in the waiting room with a handful of treats. She read out his weight. The number caught my breath. It was the same as mine had been when I was at my lightest. I looked at my dog, all muscle and bone, and I thought of myself 2 decades in the past, swooning when the dizziness hit. In the waiting room, I was reflected in a body twice that size. Something came unmoored in me. I looked into the trusting face of my dog and I stopped believing I could go there again. I stopped wanting to. After a decade photographing, I sometimes feel complicit in something malign, in being part of a system that misrepresents the human form and spreads dissatisfaction. Then a drag performer will lean over my shoulder to see the image on the back of the camera and laugh, saying, "Those are my mother's cheekbones. The light found them." In these shoots, I am a prospector, mining the things that lie unseen beneath the surface of the skin. These are the days that make me love the craft, the ones that carve another world into existence. They are a reminder to stop thinking of a photo as authority and start seeing it as sorcery. The camera lies, and so do the eyes. There is no truth, only versions upon versions. The body shimmers at the edges of vision, waiting to be coalesced.
Thank you so much, Sarah. It was a beautiful reading, and yeah, it just makes me quite sad to realize that so many people have that story or that moment when they first saw their body and didn't like what they saw. I think mine was probably around a similar age, and I think it was wearing a pair of pedal pushers that I couldn't zip up. So thank you very much for sharing that. It was really beautiful. First off, I wanted to ask a question to both of you. Maybe Sarah, I'll get you to answer first because your book came out more recently. I wanted to ask you about what it's been like to launch these really beautiful embodied books into the world in these decidedly disembodied times. How has the Zoomification of publishing affected your ideas about your books and perhaps about your bodies? And I guess, what has this experience been like in comparison to your expectations?
It's been strange in many ways to release a book about a body in a time when my own body monitoring has been even more heightened than usual because I'm constantly running a little subroutine that's going, do I have a sore throat? Do I have a cough? Maybe I've got a cough. Am I tired? Maybe I've got muscle. Do I have COVID? I've got COVID. So it's been kind of strange, the isolation of writing and releasing a book entirely in lockdown. And that book advocating so deeply for a kind of community and a lack of shame and connection and sharing, and that sharing having to happen in such a disembodied format has been odd. That said, I mean, I haven't released a book before, and so I haven't. I've known people who've said, "Oh, you know, you're missing all of the incredible, you know, the launches and the events and the people sitting listening to you." And because I haven't had that before, I haven't felt its loss so keenly. But it's also been really beautiful to have these responses coming in a digital and a virtual way, because it means that people can speak to me very, very vulnerably. It's not them having to pull me aside at a writer's festival and be like, hey, I want to tell you about this experience I had. It's meant that people can do it in Instagram DMs and emails and text messages. And in that way, I think some of those conversations have been able to be longer and broader than they might otherwise have been, which has been really validating and lovely.
Yeah, wonderful. I'm glad that you've been, finding ways to hold that space for people, but I also hope that you've, had boundaries around it as well. Sam, what has your experience been like? Like, what has basically, I mean, you had your first launch in person, I do know that, but then after that, like, every publicity thing was basically online for you as well.
Yeah, it's been a really strange time. I think a lot of my experience is similar to Sarah's in that there's been a lot of Instagram DMs, and I think people have the time to sit with their own experience and reflect a bit more on it now and are perhaps willing to share in that way. That, I mean, I also haven't published a book before, so I don't know if this is normal, but that's been a really meaningful way to connect with people. I was really lucky to have, so the book was originally meant to be published in August 2020. That got pushed out to February 2021. I launched it in this brief magical moment where we could be in rooms together and hold one another and share cupcakes, and it was so fantastic. But then after that, it's all been Zoomified, and that has been strange, but also selfishly kind of nice. It allows me to sort of create a safe space either side of an event that doesn't involve a lot of the usual social anxiety and hard sort of mental work that's involved with putting your body in the world. So in some ways it's been more accessible than I imagine book publishing and promotion would be generally. So it's made self-care easier.
Yeah, wonderful. Not having to navigate going on crowded trams to events and then, the awkwardness of goodbyes and all that sort of social stuff that's really quite difficult, and especially difficult when you're sort of the center of attention, which weirdly a lot of writers aren't so into despite the fact that their books do, attract attention.
Especially memoirs.
Funny that. Yeah. I wanted to ask you both about this, but maybe I'll start with Sam. What first drew you to writing about bodies, and how have your ideas about embodiment and its challenges been transformed through the process of writing?
I think I arrived not by will, but by necessity. Body writing is something that I enjoy reading and that I feel most compelled by. So I think I sort of had to write about my body. Also because I didn't see my own body being represented in the written form very much. And where it is represented, especially in pop culture, it's usually it's the butt of jokes, or so as a woman in a fat body, it's hard to feel seen through the culture that I'm consuming. How it's changed my understanding of my own body, I think I've become more attuned to the changes. I think especially in terms of things like my relationship with food, that's not a static relationship, and I don't think it ever will be. Even for people with a very good and healthy relationship with food, that often will change seasonally. It will change depending on, how much time you've got, how much income you've got, all of those things. And I think having written those things in detail makes me very aware of where those shifts are within myself, within my mental health.
Thank you very much, Sam. And what about you, Sarah? What sort of drew you to writing about the body in your work?
I had this kind of embarrassing revelation not actually very long ago where I have been an avid reader my whole life, but I read very little nonfiction because all the nonfiction I was exposed to as a young person was like, and then we went to Stalingrad and it was bad, and then we went to another war and that was also bad. My idea of what nonfiction was men reading books about wars and men reading books about economics. I worked in a secondhand bookshop and I was always like, oh, no, don't look at that. And then I read The Argonauts by Maggie Nelson and I was like, holy shit, are you kidding me? You can write like this? You can write nonfiction that's this invigorating and generous and funny and sexy, and that just absolutely blew my tiny little mind. And then about 5 years ago, I had an abortion and I started writing in a kind of diaristic way about that. And then I got a bit annoyed that I hadn't read any experiences of that process that felt like what I had experienced. All the Googling I was doing was articles accompanied by the same type of image. It was a woman sitting against a wall with her head in her hands. And I was like, I didn't feel like that. That wasn't what that was like for me. It was much more complicated than that. And so writing that essay made me realize that there was this huge well of interest within within me and all these conversations I'd been having for decades with people about why is it so scary to be in a body? Why are we filled with so much shame about having bodies that don't do what they're told to all the time? And so once I started thinking and writing in that space, all this content just poured out, which was so thrilling and validating. And it's been so nice to talk to people who are like, ah, oh, I've been annoyed about these things too. And so that process, similarly to you, Sam, I think that process of realizing that our relationships with our bodies are constantly moving is so important to recognize. I think often in nonfiction and memoir, there's this real drive towards a kind of narrative where it was bad, but now it's good. It was out of control and now it's in control. And I think it's been really, really helpful to write into that space and go, oh, no, it's constantly changing. I'll never feel in control of this. And maybe there will come a time where that feels okay.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really interesting as well. I think you both write a lot about control in your books, and write a lot about the unruliness of the body and like trying to squash that unruliness. And I wanted to ask you a bit about both of you, but I'll ask you one at a time, about how these ideas of control intersect with your writing. And, you know, do you find that writing feeds into these particular, you know, ideas about control, or do you find that it's sort of a way of sort of freeing yourself from some of these ways that you've tried to control your body, if that makes any sense? Sorry, it's a bit of a convoluted question. Sam, did you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot lately, just in terms of what it is that a memoir does to your personal history and your narrative about yourself, because when you don't have it written down, there's all sorts of flexibility in memory where you get to, as you remember things, memories change, and that's sort of an established scientific truth, that the more you use a memory, the more it changes. Whereas when you write them down, they stop changing because you've sort of pinned the memory down. And I'm really interested in how your understanding of yourself stops moving in the same way or something. It's almost like, as a writer, there's always a narrativizing voice that exists while I'm living in the world that's sort of going, well, is this material? Maybe I could do this with that. But also, I don't know, I just feel like it does something about the stuckness of memory and sort of shifts it a bit.
Absolutely.
I listened to a talk with BJ Silcox and Helen Garner recently, where Garner quoted Joan Didion saying that it's not this exact quote, but it's something along the lines of, writers are lonely, anxious rearrangers of things. And I was like, ooh, yeah. that idea of rearranging experience so that it makes sense or makes less sense or makes a different kind of sense really resonated with me. And the idea that by locking down something, it makes a kind of sense. But it's been really interesting since I wrote an essay at the start of the pandemic when my mother died, which is the final essay in the book. And I was writing very rapidly and very responsively at that time. And then I finished it and it's been edited. And even now I find going back to it, there's things in there that I've completely forgotten already. Even though I've written them, I've formed them into this narrative, my memories of things continue to shift and change. But instead of going back to my own memory, I'm going back to a different memory that I laid down at a different time. And there's this strange kind of dual Sarahs, one of whom has crystallized something and the other of whom is constantly coming back and checking and changing. And that feels very, very curious. But I think writers are, you know, typically described as being very good noticers of things, which I think is very true, but I think also speaks to the fact that writers are always running a little subroutine going, that could be a thing, I'll take that. Or maybe, that's happening, but also I'm paying attention to this other thing. So the kind of controlling, filtering process is constantly happening. But interestingly, I feel like in pretty much every experience I have, I'm a bit worried about mass and about things feeling like they're not being controlled. But the great thing about the way I write is that there's a generation process where I'm just dumping thoughts as they occur to me. I'm being like, right, I'm writing 1,000 words. It doesn't matter what it is. It actually doesn't matter. And I'm just amassing ideas. And then there is the editing process. I edit very aggressively. But I feel like writing is the one space where that kind of excess and then control feels all right and doesn't feel like it's actually doing damage. It feels like it's creating something that feels pared back. And I'm aware now, Lee and I have been thinking, Sam, about your book and how so many of the responses to it have used eating words. I devoured it. I was ravenous for your book. I ate it up. Mm. And the way I'm talking about editing is the same. I'm paring it back, like I'm stripping it away. I'm cleaning it up. There are all ways that we talk about eating and dieting in our bodies as well. It's so inescapable. We can't have language that isn't tied to this weird judgment about the way that we exist in the world.
Mm.
There you go. That's a long rambling response to that question.
No, that was really interesting as well because, you know, when you think about, you know, one of the principles of CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy, which is one of the leading sort of psychological solutions to anxiety that people talk about, so much of that is supposed to be about, you know, having thoughts come in and then letting them go and not necessarily jumping to that sort of judgment or interpretation, whereas writing kind of can encourage us to do the opposite of that. Anyway, that's just a little thought I had just then. But, I also wanted to talk to you particularly, Sarah, about your photography practice and the photographic medium and how, especially in the age of Photoshop, it sort of changes and corrupts our perceptions of ourselves. Could you speak a little bit about your photography and how that might intersect with your writing practice or if you don't really think it does or how they might rub up against each other?
Well, totally. I think they're both very public modes of engaging with the world. I mean, photography, there has never been a time when I photographed that I wasn't also putting those photographs online as a representation of myself and my work, which is also the case with the vast majority of my writing. When I started taking photographs, I was posting them on Flickr. And then Facebook started and then I uploaded my first profile picture and got my first like and, ooh, that felt good. But I'm so hyper aware of the fact that the self that I am photographing is not how I actually look. I mean, you know, like that, the idea of actually looking like anything is kind of meaningless. But yeah, you know, my partner looks at the photos I take of myself and he goes, oh, you're doing the boss bitch face again. And I'm like, that's my face. And he's like, you don't look like that. You don't ever look that like frightening. you're a very like smiley person. And in all my photos, I'm like, yeah. Look, I'm just going to turn my chin slightly to the right because my left jawline is a little bit more defined and I'm going to photograph myself just from a little bit higher so that the cheekbones get like it's all just – it's fucked, but I'm aware that I'm doing it. But I'm aware that when I'm putting those photos on the internet where I'm like, I mean, I got rid of some pimples and I've reduced my under-eye bags, but I don't say that in the captions. And so I'm sure there are people who've never met me who look at photos of me and go, well, glamorous lady, where usually I look as though I just fell out of a hedge. And it's, you know, it's damaging, even knowing that we all filter the way that we appear publicly. It doesn't really help to know that everyone does it, because these sort of flat pack selves that we encounter online, they feel real. They look real and I think partly this idea that the camera never lies is really, really damaging, because a camera is wielded by a person and the way that you wield it changes the result. Like if I look at photos I've taken, because I do a lot of event photography for the theater. One day I'll get to do it again. What a thrill. I can look at photos that I've taken of people at an event before I knew them, and they look totally different to the photos I take of people once I know them and care about them or think they're a bit of an arrogant dick. Like I photograph people differently based on how I feel about them, and that should tell you everything you need to know about how the camera is not a neutral object. Writing has been interesting because it's very open and it's very vulnerable, but in some ways it feels safer or less raw or less fraught maybe than the way I photograph myself, because the editing that I do when I'm writing feels different to the editing that I do to my face. Maybe because everyone knows that writers edit aggressively, but not everyone knows that I make my eyes a little bit whiter when I upload photos of myself. Yeah,
wonderful. And I think, the idea that that the camera never lies is such a dangerous one, because we all know it does, and we all are so hyper aware of the way that we look, the way that we're perceived, especially now because we're always on Zoom with a little photo of ourselves looking back at us as we are right now. It's just this constant sort of battle with this, you know, these ideas of ourselves versus what we want to present to the world. And I think, it's a particular historical moment for that. Sam, I wanted to talk to you a bit about, you were talking a bit about memory before, and I'm really interested in your idea in your book that memory is located in the body. Like I loved how you wrote about how your memory was located in your legs. How do you think about memory when you're writing, and do you have rituals or methods to map memory or to find holes in, you know, your stories?
Yeah, so
the stories that you've grown up with or things like that as well.
So the book started as an honours project, and the thing about honours projects is that you have to go in with a question. So the question that I went in with was how I could create something for the page that mimicked the way that memories work in relation to food, and what the possibilities of essays were in that space. And that for me is super exciting because I'm a big craft geek. So I was really sort of interested in the idea of the ways that memory fragments, the ways that memory associates, the ways it gets really sort of tangled and sticky, and some memories are sort of tiny little blips and others, you know, go on and sort of pull in all of this material behind them. And food is a particularly fun place for that. Don't know if fun's the right word. It's a particularly active place for that. So part of my research method, I suppose, was first to deal with involuntary memories, which especially around food writing, I mean, everybody knows about Proust and his Madeleine, that, you know, he eats a biscuit and some tea and suddenly remembers his whole childhood in 7 large volumes. So, yeah, it's not a new idea that the body holds on to memory. But it's interesting in how involuntary, how persistent it can be when it's within your own body, that you don't notice until, you know, you're eating a mango and remembering a share house and your partner. And
just about to say, I mean, in the same way that we talk about Proust and the Madeleine, maybe in 10 years' time we'll be talking about San and the mango.
Oh, that's so lovely. Thank you.
And it's interesting, isn't it, that like culturally there's certain things that we know and that are kind of obvious. Like, of course, your body remembers the experiences that it's had. And of course, food holds so many memories, but we sort of have to keep relearning it in the same way that, like, in the 70s when people were like, hey, I had this thought, maybe trauma impacts your mental health later. Like, maybe if your body has had a bad thing happen to it, your body expects other bad things to happen to it. Everyone was like, oh my God, what a crazy idea. And it was like, no, but what, are you serious? Like, that's so obvious. And yet we still, you know, like this, you know, the body keeps a score is like, everyone I know is like, this book changed my life. And, but of course our bodies remember these things, but we sort of live this strange life where we're in these heads floating above these meat objects, which are just constantly causing this irritation. And whereas, yeah, like, I think we're constantly having to return to our bodies and be like, oh, you remember stuff. I don't just remember stuff in my brain. You remember stuff in your cells and your skin and your hormones.
Mm. I'm so interested. Sarah, did you read The Body Keeps the Score as part of your research?
I have actually somehow managed not to read it. I don't know what that's about. I think actually when I was writing, I was trying quite hard to be reading mostly kind of like academic articles and research that wasn't, that didn't feel anywhere close to essays, because I was worried that I would kind of, they would bleed into my own writing. But I have to read it. I've had so many people talk to me about it. And yeah, like.
Yeah, there's a whole chapter in there on theatre, which while I was reading your book, I was very like, oh, this really brings the idea of theatre as an embodied practice to life for me in a way that Bessel van der Kolk didn't quite. Like, he talks about it in a very mechanical sort of way, and as a non-theatre person, I didn't quite get it. Like, I wanted to get it, but I didn't quite. But there's something in The First Time I Thought I Was Dying that makes it really understandable even to people that aren't theatre people. So,
oh, great! Yeah. That's good to hear.
Sorry, yeah, I did want to ask you a bit about theatre and acting and your book as well, Sarah. So, if you wanted to talk a little bit about that, that would be great.
The theatre, So I came to art primarily as an actor, mostly because I was a very precocious, irritating child who wouldn't shut up, and so my parents were like, "We'll send her to acting classes," and then people will clap when she won't shut up. That's very mean about my parents. It was great. And for a while, I really thought I was going to be an actor. I had these roles. I had people telling me that I was going to be very clever at it, provided that I unbuttoned my shirt a little bit and dyed my hair. And so when I came to university, it was as an actor and a theatre performer. And I was surrounded by all these people who were so thrilled about the idea of using our bodies to change people, to tell stories, to change ourselves and to change the audience. And I write about the kind of danger of young people being very into Artaud and his writing about the theatre of cruelty. And because we were all 20 and weren't really very interested in actually reading the theory, we were like, oh, cruelty means being awful to people. So we're going to make shows where there's going to be a bit where we pass around a bucket full of offal and everyone's got to, so it's kind of going off and everyone's got to smell it. And yeah, that'll shake the audience out of their safety and security. And it took a very long time to realize that actually when you make people feel unsafe, they don't come with you anymore. They don't want to hear what you have to say. And I think the theatre's really been grappling with that in the wake of Me Too, because the theatre is a space where you use your body to do some pretty strange things, and it's a workplace where you're asked to do things that in any other workplace would be pretty alarming. But because of that, there has been a tendency to make workplaces that aren't very safe for the performers and also for the audiences. And that has been a real shift that is occurring and hopefully will continue to occur, of saying actually having your body perform something very traumatic encodes that in your body. And making an audience member watch something that's very traumatic is really fucking triggering if it's also happened to you. And when we were 20, most of us hadn't had very many bad things happen to us or hadn't gone through enough therapy to realize that they had. So yeah, there, you know, there's, I sort of tried to convey in the book the fact that, I mean, it wasn't just all damaging and terrible. It was also glorious. And when you're on stage and things are going a little bit wrong and you're having to fix them live, you feel alive in a way that I don't think I've ever really felt since. It is such a, it's such a glorious feeling. But you can have that, that, extraordinary electricity and still have people go home and feel safe.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think, yeah, we're sort of moving more towards this idea of, you know, how can we embrace our bodies and how can we keep them safe? And I'm wondering for both of you, what does it say, I guess, about our society that taking joy in our bodies or looking after our bodies or being kind to them, especially in the relation to the fat body, but, well, you know, in relation to the disabled body and all these bodies that are sort of squished into certain.
I think there's that's really, it's a really interesting question. Embracing your body is a radical act. There's something about body positivity and the moment that it's having, I think, that feels really good when you can do that work and land in a place where you look in the mirror and maybe you don't hate it or like you don't have to love it, but maybe you can manage. That's a radical thing and it feels amazing. Having said that, there's something about the pressure to feel an individual responsibility for that relationship to your body that is so tricky and really passes the buck. So I think it's great to be able to live in your body and feel okay and get by and not feel all of the shame and the fear and the self-blame and the chaos and all of those things. To let go of those is really a revolutionary thing to do. But at the same time, there are all of these systemic and structural things around like medical bias against fat people that means that most fat women will have a story where they go into the doctor for an earache and the doctor starts a conversation about weight loss surgery. Or, you know, they're given weight loss outcomes as the way to fix it for anything, whether it's weight related or not. So I'm more interested at the moment in how we can make those systems accountable, how we can make the structures that make those poor relationships with our bodies happen in the first place, how we can make those answerable for the ways that we're treated.
Yeah, totally. And I think one of the things that I found really surprising about the Health at Every Size movement, because it came up on my Instagram, I feel like that's how so many people I know got to experience this amazing new world where we got to not absolutely hate ourselves all the time. The idea that measuring behaviors, good behaviors, like bodies, they need nourishment and they have to move. And being like, how do we make that feel good for you? We're so... It's kind of strange and thrilling for me. And I realized how much of my life I'd spent, you talk in your book, Sam, it comes up so much and I found it just so gut-wrenching to recognize this idea of trying, just trying and trying and trying and trying. And the amount of energy I've put throughout my life into just trying to be less, trying to be less anxious, trying to be lighter, trying to be quieter, trying to behave better, trying to be good. And I really like the idea that we can create structures in society that mean that moving and being nourished, they're not really fucking hard. Like days where you're like, hey, I just worked 12 hours and now I guess I'll go to the gym. I'm so tired. But I'll go to the gym and I'll stand in front of my fridge and will it to cook something for me. But no, I'll cook it. It's exhausting. Like late capitalism is not great. Late capitalism, especially when you don't have a wife at home who's doing all the cooking and cleaning, it's totally untenable. And so when I was in the research for the book, I spoke to several researchers from the Charles Perkins Institute in Sydney who research the kind of relationships between public health messaging and legislation and our bodies. And I was kind of expecting to be having conversations with people being like, oh, we've got an obesity epidemic, or everybody needs to be doing a better job. And all these people were like, it's really hard to look after your bodies, actually. Shouldn't be. So it should be the case that every single address in Australia is within walking distance of healthy food retail. And that's not the case in most places. It should be the case that every school has a walkable route to it, so kids can walk to school, not because they'll lose weight, because mostly they don't, but they'll start to develop a relationship with their bodies where their bodies can do things instead of being a body that needs to be suppressed. So kids start being like, my body's really strong. Hey, I'll race you to that letterbox. Oh my God, have you seen that bird? That bird's here again. Like they have, it has all these incredible mental health ramifications. So yeah, all of these researchers were like, we're just trying to make it so that it's a bit easier to look after your body. And I was like, wow, I sort of hadn't thought before about the fact that we live in a world that actually makes it really hard.
I think the 5 kilometer radius during lockdown made some of those realities super obvious. Like the amount of people, while we all got to go to parks or, you know, get better takeaway or whatever, the amount of people that were stuck in areas that didn't have parks or didn't have a supermarket with fresh produce, or, you know, it just became really obvious as to how isolated some people were with their access to the things that help you nurture a body.
Yeah. And even things like, you know, one of the researchers I spoke to, he was like, look, I walk to work every day and I'm a healthy weight and my body's pretty, you know, pretty healthy. And I'm very aware that there are a lot of privileges that come with that. I am genetically very healthy. I'm wealthy. I live walking distance from my work. I have a lot of free time, so I can cook, yada, yada, yada. And he was sort of saying, you know, if you're talking to a parent, a single parent of a bunch of several kids who has to drive for an hour and a half to get to the factory that they work at every day, because there's literally no safe way for them to, they can't ride there, it's too far. There's no safe way to get public transport. He's like, how do you say to that person, oh, well, it's your fault because you didn't go to the gym 4 times a week? He's like, they're just trying to keep their family alive. Yeah, and it made me feel really good that the researchers who are doing this work are really, really aware of the role of the government in making this a thing that is easier for us, which I found really reassuring.
Absolutely. And I think, yes, I think it's definitely a symptom of the times that we live in, that we sort of take these structural issues and make them about individuals. So I think it's really wonderful that you've both written these books that are so rousing. They are very much about the self, but they're also about our connections with one another and about the ways that we can sort of, you know, we can build these sort of communities that are supportive of one another and can make us feel all right about living in a world that maybe isn't so nice to us. So I just wanted to say thank you to both of you for doing that. I think these books are a testament to both your talents and your compassion and your wanting to make this a better world, which I think is commendable. So that's about all the time we have for our interview today, but I just wanted to say thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Eloise.
Thank you so much to both of you. What a delight.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.